We'll be turning today to 2 Samuel chapter 7. Excuse me, 1 Samuel chapter 7. Just test in there, see if you're awake. First Samuel chapter 7. In the early chapters of this book, we've seen that Israel has been largely not pleasing to God. There has not been extensive description of their behavior, of their wrong behavior, but there has been indication that they have been serving idols as well as Jehovah. This is probably the most typical situation in Old Testament history, is that the Jews would, they would never give up entirely on worshiping Jehovah, although under Ahab and Jezebel tried to extinguish all worship of Jehovah in favor of replacing that with the worship of Baal. But there were many times, perhaps most of the time in Israel's Old Testament history, they did worship other gods as well as Jehovah, and he endured them with great patience, and that is, he didn't wipe them out as early as he could have. But he did see to it that they had indicators of his displeasure from time to time, perhaps one of the most significant of which was the capture of the Ark of the Covenant by the Philistines, which occurred, of course, back in chapter 4 of 1 Samuel. Now, even though God had intended to punish Israel or give a token of his disapproval with their spiritual state, by the capture of the Ark, he did not give the Philistines a good time with the Ark. He plagued their cities and caused them to break out with hemorrhoids, and apparently some plague-like circumstances attended the arrival of the Ark wherever it went, so the Philistines sent it back. And when it arrived back into the territory of Israel, it came to Kirjath-Jearim, and it actually came to Beth-Shemesh first, and then they sent it to Kirjath-Jearim after even the people of that first location, Beth-Shemesh, experienced the stroke of God's anger because they looked into the Ark, apparently viewing it more as an article of curiosity than a sacred thing that it represented. Anyway, at the end of chapter 6, it says in verse 21, they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kirjath-Jearim, saying, "The Philistines have brought back the Ark of the Lord. Come down and take it with you." Now, we're not told why the people of Beth-Shemesh wanted the people of Kirjath-Jearim to take responsibility for the Ark, or why it should go there. There's no rationale given. The fact is, Kirjath-Jearim is the next major town from Beth-Shemesh in the direction of Shiloh. That is, if you were traveling towards Shiloh from Beth-Shemesh, you'd come to Kirjath-Jearim next. So it may be that the idea of moving the Ark more toward its original location was in mind. But the fact that they didn't take it all the way to Shiloh is significant, and probably is due to the fact that Shiloh had been destroyed by the Philistines in the same war that had resulted in the capture of the Ark. And therefore, there was probably no more the tabernacle in Shiloh at this point. So the Ark was kept for the time being in the home of a man named Abinadab. We read of this in chapter 7, verse 1. The men of Kirjath-Jearim came and took the Ark of the Lord and brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to keep the Ark of the Lord. We don't read of any great displeasure of God in this decision. Therefore, we must assume that both Abinadab and his son Eleazar were, in some sense, related to the priestly line. It certainly would have been unacceptable to God for the Ark to reside in the home of and be cared for a man who was not a priest. And so, although we know nothing else about these men, we can assume the probability that priests are of a priestly family, and they became the attendants of the Ark, and it stayed there for 20 years. In verse 2, it says, "So it was that the Ark remained in Kirjath-Jearim a long time." It was there 20 years. "And all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord." Now, it doesn't say where the Ark went after that 20 years. It doesn't state it here. But later on, David wished to remove the Ark to Jerusalem, and it was no longer here. It was at another man's house, Obed-Edom. And so, apparently, we don't know why it left this place, Abinadab's house, after 20 years, but it apparently, I don't know, maybe he died or something, and they decided to take it somewhere else. We're just not informed. Verse 3, "Then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, If you return to the Lord with all your hearts, then put away the foreign gods and the Ashtoreths from among you. Now, Ashtoreths were the images of a Canaanite goddess, Asherah. And this goddess, archaeologists have found Ashtoreths, and it is a very, very perverted image. She was a fertility goddess, and the way they depicted her was extremely lewd, as a matter of fact. And in fact, people who've done excavations in Canaan or in Palestine of the Canaanite civilizations before the Jews conquered, or during the time of the Jews, have said that much of what they have found about the Canaanite worship was lewd and so corrupt and perverted that they could not describe it in the Christian books that report it. These people were into a fertility cult. As well as worshiping Jehovah, they also worshiped a Canaanite fertility god and goddess. And it's amazing that they were tolerated this long by God, because this is very abominable. So Samuel says, listen, if you want God to take care of you and deliver you from the Philistines and so forth, rather than have them conquer you, you need to get right with God, and you need to put away all your idols from among you and prepare your hearts for the Lord and serve Him only, and He'll deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. Now, this might seem like a simple and a modest proposal. I mean, the Jews should have no objection to giving up their idols. They never legitimately had them anyway. It was a part of their founding as a nation that they would serve no other gods. They'd make no graven images. They'd not bow down and worship anyone except Jehovah. And therefore, it might seem strange to us that this request would have to even be brought to them, or that if it did, it would represent any great piety on their fact to comply on their part. But I suppose if God would speak to us in our generation, to the Christian church in America, and say you need to put away your idols, and those would include, and he begins to list them, our materialism and some of the tokens of our materialism that are part of our lifestyle. Some people, it might be a car or a stereo, or it might be their television, or it might be their record collection or whatever. I have a feeling it would be difficult for many Christians. It would be something that they've never considered doing. But the doing of it, they might do it, depending on how mightily the Spirit of God convicted them about it. But I don't know that it'd be the easiest thing in the world for some people. We had a student here, I think it was at the beginning of last year, who had a CD collection that was worth over $1,000. And, of course, it doesn't take much to get a CD collection worth over $1,000 since they're so expensive individually. But I think it was worth about $1,100. And he just became convicted that it was an idol to him. It was all secular CDs. And I think they were all secular. They might not have all been. But it's largely a secular collection. He just tossed them in the dumpster out here. You probably remember that, Derek, don't you? That hasn't happened very often here at the school, mostly because most students don't bring their idols with them to the school here to do that. But he actually didn't live on the campus. He lived down the street. But so he had all this stuff available, and that was quite a move. I mean, everyone was impressed that God had really moved on him, because those had been very important to him. Anyway, Samuel is telling the children of Israel that the only way they're going to come out from under this displeasure of God that's caused them to be defeated in their battles to the Philistines, they're going to have to give up all their idols, which they should have done without being asked anyway. They should have never had the idols. So the children of Israel put away the Baals and the Ashtoreths, and served the Lord only, for a little while anyway. And Samuel said, gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you. So they gathered together at Mizpah, drew water, and poured it out before the Lord. Now, the ceremony of drawing water and pouring out before the Lord is not anything for which we find instructions in the law. In all the rituals of sacrifice and so forth in the Old Testament, we don't find instructions about drawing water and pouring it out before the Lord, although it is done at other times in Scripture. In fact, it later became part of a regular ritual of the tabernacles. And many people believe that when Jesus in John chapter 7 stood up on the great day of the Feast of Tabernacles and said, if anyone thirsts, let him come unto me and drink. And as the Scripture said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water. Most scholars believe that Jesus said that in conjunction with a known practice of the Jews of pouring out water before the Lord in that very festival that it is said Jesus was at. Now, this practice of pouring out water was not dictated in Scripture. It became a later tradition of the Jews. And whether this was done at the... I mean, it's hard to know exactly what the basis or the meaning of this ritual was or what its origin was. For lack of any better explanation, it may be that the pouring out of water before the Lord may have represented people pouring out their hearts to God, pouring out their prayers to God, maybe pouring out themselves. But we don't know. All of these would only be guesses. It obviously must have symbolized something, because pouring water out of a bucket is not in itself a sacred act or an act of worship, except, of course, as it has symbolic meaning. And since we are at, God never instructed this particular ritual, we don't have a clue, really, what the meaning was. But they did it here, and it was done on other occasions, too, after this. So they drew water and poured it out before the Lord, and they fasted that day and said there, "We have sinned against the Lord." And Samuel judged the children of Israel at Mizpah. Now, judged them probably refers to actually hearing their cases, like Moses did before his father-in-law suggested dividing his responsibilities among lesser persons who could handle the easier cases. Moses would sit there and people would bring all their cases to him, and he'd judge them out of the law of God, or like the judges in the book of Judges did. Samuel, after all, was a judge. But how long this meeting at Mizpah continued, we don't know. Was it a week long or what? I mean, I don't know how many cases were brought to him at this time. It's possible that he judged the nation corporately. Rather than taking individual cases for consideration, he may have just judged the basic corporate sins of the nation. But again, we don't have enough information to put a specific picture to what was going on here. Now, when the Philistines heard that the children of Israel had gathered together at Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. Now, this is because the children of Israel were, at that point in time, a subject people. They were subject to the Philistines, as they had been under the time of, in the days of Samson. Samson had never completely delivered Israel from the Philistines, and that condition prevailed for many years into the time of Samuel, although it came to an end at this point in time. In this chapter. But the Philistines saw the gathering of the children of Israel at Mizpah as, a bid for national independence. And, in fact, it probably was correctly interpreted that way. So the Philistines decided to quell this rebellion, and they gathered their armies and came up against Israel. That is, they encamped within view of Israel, intending to attack. And when the children of Israel heard of it, they were afraid of the Philistines. So the children of Israel said to Samuel, "Do not cease to cry out to the Lord our God for us, that he may save us from the hand of the Philistines." Now, this is common enough in Scripture, but I should point it out from time to time when we come across it. And that is that salvation and deliverance and victory in war was always, whenever people were thinking rightly about it, of the Lord. It was not a question of, do we have adequate armies? Do we have adequate armaments? The question is, will God deliver us out of the hands of the Philistines? Now, up to this point, the Israelites had been very inadequate to throw off the yoke of the Philistines, or else they would have done so. They didn't have adequate military organization or a military machine to throw off the oppression that was upon them from the Philistines. And in all likelihood, they didn't at this point either. But they knew that the Lord could deliver them, and in fact, as it turns out, he did. And this is simply the biblical view of war. The biblical view of war is that God uses war. And, he will deliver those whom he chooses to deliver. And he will punish through war those whom he chooses to punish. The more secular view of war is either that, you're on the side of your own country because it's your country, no matter what their cause in the war is. Maybe they have a just cause or not, but it happens to be your country, so you fight for your country. And whoever has the fiercest armies and the superior weaponry will win. Or some believe, especially Christians many times believe, that the army that has justice on its side, or has the more just cause, is the side that we should champion, and we should fight on the side of justice. But as a matter of fact, God is the one who dictated when the Israelites should fight, and he dictated the outcome of all the battles. And war is seen in Scripture as something entirely related to God's sovereign judging of nations. He will use even a wicked nation at times to punish another wicked nation. In fact, the nation he uses to do the punishing may be more wicked than the wicked nation they punish. And this bothered Habakkuk, as you find out when you study that book. He was concerned because God was using Babylon to judge Judah. And Judah was wicked, but Babylon was more wicked. And Habakkuk couldn't understand why God would do that. And God simply pointed out that both nations deserve judgment and will both be judged. God just happened to be using the larger one to judge the smaller one first. Then Babylon would receive judgment in time. But war is seen in Scripture, and the outcome of war is seen as always related to what God wants to be done. In Daniel chapter 2, it says that God raises up kings, and he puts down kings. God is the one who raises up rulers and brings them down. And throughout history, a very large number of rulers have been brought up or put down through means of war. Nations brought low through war or exalted through war. And that doesn't mean war is good or bad in itself. It just means it's the tool that God uses. Now, it may be that Christians should have nothing to do with war, and many Christians, myself included, would prefer to see Christians have nothing to do with war. But even having said that, we have to recognize that much of the things that we would have nothing to do with, because it's not our place, it's not our calling, are nonetheless things that God uses in the overall shaping of history, because he's a sovereign God, and he has reserved the right to shape history, including dumping of nations that displease him, and the raising up of others that he chooses to use. Anyway, the children of Israel knew that their fortunes in the battle would be based on one thing, and that is whether God was on their side. And they urged the prophet to pray for them, to cry out to the Lord for them, to give them victory, to save them from the Philistines. And Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. Then Samuel cried out to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him. Now as Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to the battle against Israel. But the Lord thundered with a loud thunder upon the Philistines that day, and so confused them that they were overcome before Israel. Now, many of the victories that Israel won over larger enemies and mightier enemies than themselves were won, as we shall see and even already saw in the book of Judges in the days of Gideon, for example, by throwing the enemy into confusion. It was not necessary that Israel had better weapons, but they had a more powerful God on their side, and he was able to throw the enemy into utter confusion. In the days of Jehoshaphat, considerably later than this, he was besieged by three nations, and the armies that were coming against him were far more mighty than he. This is in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, it talks about this. And God just had them send the musicians out to worship the Lord before the armies, and God threw the enemy into confusion, so the enemy killed each other rather than killing the Israelites whom they'd come to get. And the same thing happened in the days of Gideon, and God did that with the Midianites. God throws the enemies into confusion so that they don't know, they can't organize themselves against God's people. And many times they're so confused they kill each other instead of the people they came to attack. And this is something like what God did here. We don't know that God had the Philistines killing each other, but they were too confused to really fight this battle in an organized way, and they were confused largely because God thundered loudly. Now, I doubt that this just means there was a thunderstorm. I'm sure that the people of that part of the world had seen thunder before, and they weren't so superstitious as to think that because there was thunder, they shouldn't fight. After all, remember, in an earlier battle, the Philistines had been terrified. If you want to talk about superstitious fear, they were terrified because the Jews would bring the ark out. And then the Philistines won anyway and took the ark. I mean, they certainly had no reason to be superstitious about portents and things like that. The thundering must have been very exceptional. It must have been very deafening. It must have been very distracting. It was more than just occasional, you know, just an electrical storm, apparently. It was something very loud, something very distracting, something very confusing. Just a constant din of noise, perhaps. We don't know. But something about it was supernatural. And it caused the Philistines to be so confused that they couldn't fight. Now, why the Israelites didn't become confused by it is an interesting question. I think probably the confusion of the Philistines was a supernatural effect that God put upon them. Then the men of Israel went out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and drove them back as far as below Beth-kar. Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shen, called its name Ebenezer, which means a stone of help, saying, "Thus far the Lord has helped us." The Ebenezer would stand like so many other stones that God had the Israelites set up in different places in the days of Joshua, for example. as a memorial of God's help in this occasion, where it was very clear that the Israelites could not save themselves and did not save themselves. They did participate in the battle, but it was clear that God's supernatural involvement and intervention is what caused them to win. So they could look at that stone forever after and remember, God saved us because we happened to have cried out to Him and because we got it right with Him. We'd given up our idols. And this stone would be continually a memorial to them of the need to avoid idolatry and to be right with God, so that when enemies come, God would be inclined to help them as He had up to this point here. So the Philistines were subdued, and they did not come any more into the territory of Israel. Now this statement, they did not come any more into the territory of Israel, should not be taken in an absolute sense. I understand it to mean they didn't conquer Israel anymore. They had, on various occasions, subjugated Israel as a people and had Israel contribute to them. This never happened again. They never came in as a dominant force into the land of Israel. They did invade on many occasions after this. We find in chapter 12 or 13, skirmishes between the Philistines and, actually it's chapter 14, I think chapter 12 has it too, between the Philistines and Jonathan, who leads Saul's troops later on. We find David dealing with the Philistines within the land. I mean, Goliath challenged the Jews after this time, and he was a Philistine, and they were in the land. So when it says the Philistines did not come in any more into the territory of Israel, it doesn't mean they never set foot on the property or never invaded. It means that they never were able to come in and take it over anymore. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. Now that means when Samuel was alive, the Philistines, although they invaded, they fell. I mean, David being a good example, killing Goliath, that was still during the lifetime of Samuel. And the children of Israel conquering the Philistines in that battle that followed the death of Goliath. However, at a later time, after Samuel was dead, the Philistines invaded again. They killed Saul and his sons. The Philistines did that. So we're to understand that this is not like the end of the career of the Philistines in the land. It's simply that in the reign of Samuel, the Philistines never were able to really come in and get the mastery as they had apparently fairly consistently before. Then the cities of the Philistines had taken from the cities which the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel, from Ekron to Gath, and Israel recovered its territory from the hands of the Philistines. Also, there was peace in Israel and the Amorites. Now, the Amorites is a generic term for all the Canaanite peoples there. Now, they shouldn't have even existed anymore, because in Joshua's day, Israel was supposed to have exterminated every last one of them, man, women, and child. There were supposed to be no more of these races left. And Moses had warned them, if you do not eliminate these people completely, they will be thorns in your eyes and problems to you. And sure enough, the Jews didn't eliminate them all, and most of the time there were problems. This speaks of a rare situation where the Amorites or the Canaanites that were left in the land, for a while, were not a problem. They weren't causing Israel any kind of grief. There was peace between them, but there would be other things, other wars with them. So Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, and he went from year to year on a circuit to Bethel, Gilgal, and Mizpah, and judged Israel in all those places. But he always returned to Ramah, for his home was there. And there he judged Israel, and there he built an altar to the Lord. So he had sort of a home church, but he did a circuit ministry. His home altar was in Ramah. By the way, that's where his mother lived, if she was still alive at this time. Which is kind of a nice thing to realize, that she had surrendered her son upon weaning him to the Lord, with the possibility being that she'd never see him again. After all, he went to live in Shiloh. She didn't live in Shiloh, but she did not anticipate someday Shiloh would cease to be a worship center and Ramah, her own hometown, where Samuel had been born, would become the worship center. There'd be an altar there. People would come there. Samuel would live there. So in his adult life, her son actually was in her own backyard, maybe even lived in her own home some of that time. We don't know. We don't read her anymore. And she may have even been dead by this time, but there's not any reason to assume that she was. This all happened probably while Samuel was still relatively young, and Hannah was probably not old and dead yet. So, we just reading between the lines, we can think it probable that Hannah, who had surrendered her son to God, received him back in her old age, as at least living in the same town. There's a story in the book Rhys Howell's Intercessor, Rhys Howells was a Welsh I don't know, he was a coal miner initially, but he became a preacher and had a healing ministry, and most notably became known for his intercessory prayer ministry, and he established the Bible College of Wales. And Norman Grubb wrote the biography of Rhys Howells. It's called Rhys Howells, Intercessor. And in that place, it's been many years since I read it, so I don't remember the details exactly, but it seems to me as he felt called, he and his wife were called to go to Africa. And they had a young son. If I'm not mistaken, it was their only child, or at least up to that point. And, boy, it's been so long, I don't remember the details. I only remember the broad outline of the story. They ended up having to leave their child. I don't know why. I wouldn't do it. But they just felt like God told them to, and I guess I'll leave that between them and God. But they left their child in America, no, in Wales, I guess, and went to Africa for many years. And it was a great sacrifice to them. But when their child was grown, he joined them on the field and worked with them and took over the ministry of his father. So it reminded me a little bit of this situation with Samuel, someone giving up their child with great difficulty in their infancy, and yet in later life having the pleasure of having their child back, you know, with them again. And this, in the case of Rhys Howells, his son, I believe, actually not only was a partner but his successor in ministry. Yet,
does it have anything to do with how, like, some missionaries like leave their kids back in the States in boarding school or whatever?
A lot of missionaries leave their kids in boarding schools on the mission field, far enough away from where they're stationed that they don't get to see them but once a year or twice a year. I personally do not approve of that. I don't think that's a good policy. But I'm also not in the position to say that God could never, ever tell someone to do that. I have met kids who were raised in these missionary boarding schools because their parents were off in the field, and they were raised in boarding school, who have turned out. So I've met some of them in YWAM. You know, the kids are serving God. It hasn't turned them against God, but far more often, the vast majority of kids raised in those schools, from what I've heard, are fairly bitter against God, and many of them don't serve the Lord, and I think their parents probably made a mistake in putting them there. I would think it extremely exceptional that God would call someone to give up their child so they can go off and minister, because generally speaking, if He's given you a child, that is your ministry. And if God calls you to additional ministry, your children will be with you and part of it. Seems to me that if Christian families feel called to plant churches in some foreign country, to take their families with them. After all, they need to model family life. The people they're ministering to aren't going to... I mean, it seems strange to me. A missionary leave their kid in a boarding school and go off and minister to families that are intact on the mission field and model themselves of neglecting their own children, you know? I mean, it seems that if you're going to plant a church and disciple, you should disciple them how to relate as Christian families, you know, in their own village or whatever. And if your own family is torn apart by this, it doesn't seem to be a natural thing. You may have heard me say before, I don't know of any cases in the Bible of God calling married people with children into missionary work. Now, that doesn't mean it never happened. I'm just saying that in the book of Acts, we never read of it. The people who were called into mission work that we read of were all single men, except the apostles, who apparently never left Jerusalem until years and years after Jesus ascended. We find them there as much as 20 years after Jesus ascended at the Council of Jerusalem. That was certainly enough time for their children to grow up before the apostles actually went out on the field. The ones who went immediately out on the field were the ones who had no families. And the ones who had families, like Peter and others, stayed in Jerusalem for as much as 20 years after the ascension of Christ. Even though they were told to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every nation, they apparently felt like, well, of course, when I'm freed up to do that, you know. I mean, of course, they had to tend the church also in Jerusalem before they could go out and plant new ones. But there's... It'd make an interesting debate to hear sides of this issue of missionaries leaving their kids boarding school debated. I would be on the side of being against it. I think it's very bad for missionary organizations to require. See, many times parents don't do this because they want to. They do it because the missionary board that they work for requires it. I met some missionaries in Maui who had been in Papua New Guinea for many years while their children were growing up. And I think the missionary board they worked for required their children at age 6 to be sent off. And these people were working with, you know, tribal people in the villages of New Guinea. But the missionary organization they worked for required the missionaries to send their kids off to some place like, you know, they could only see them once a year. And their kids were now grown. And I was talking to this older missionary couple, and the wife in particular expressed some regrets that she hadn't been able to be around her children when they were raised. And maybe even a little bit toward the organization that they'd worked for. But I can't imagine anyone preferring to send their children off. But I think this is usually done because of the policies of the missionary organizations. I think they're just wrong-headed policies. Myself and my wife, we've considered this a great deal. If we are ever sent into some malaria-infested jungles or something like that by God as missionaries, we'd take our kids with us. I mean, God gave us the kids, and whatever our fortunes are as a family, there's God intends for them to experience as well. And we'd much rather see ourselves and them in physically dangerous situations, but spiritually okay, than to put them in a place of safety somewhere else physically and have them grow bitter toward God and be spiritually ruined by it. But not all agree with that, and I certainly don't want to speak anything that would condemn families that have made other decisions. Hannah is an example of a very exceptional situation. She gave up her child. Of course, she didn't give up the child so that she could go in the ministry. She gave up her child so he would go in the ministry. But still, I wouldn't recommend parents doing that very often. But this obviously was the right thing in her case. And there may have been some other, there may have been some times when his God has called others. So rather than just completely condemning all who have, for the sake of ministry, put their children in some other situation, something I don't approve of myself generally. I can't say that God has never, ever told anyone to do that. Chapter 8, now it came to pass when Samuel was old. Now we've skipped from his youth to his old age without much detail. And the reason is we've been told that he judged Israel all the days of his life. Verse 15, that's a summary from the time he's young to the time he's old. Apparently there were no great wars to fight, no great changes in the political structure or in the religious situation of Israel during his lifetime. Israel did reasonably well and staying faithful to the Lord while Samuel was on the job. But now we skip to the end of his life. Not the very end, because he actually lives quite a bit longer after this chapter, but he's old at this point. That he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. And they were judges in Beersheba, but his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. Now, it almost sounds like a repeat of what we read about Eli. Eli had been the judge for Samuel, and Eli was punished by God and judged by God and died, and his sons died before the Lord because of corruption of his sons that he had allowed to operate in the ministry. And now we read of Samuel's sons being corrupt, and we don't find a similar judgment coming on Samuel for it. What is the reason for this? I don't know the answer, but there are many things that might be the correct answer. I mean, one thing is that Samuel was called to itinerant ministry. He traveled around. This was something that was he was required to do. Jesus did say, whoever loves wife or children or son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And some men do not have the pleasure of being stationary and being able to raise their families quite the way they would even prefer. And in some cases, it may be that God, you know, though he's not pleased with the way their children came out, he doesn't hold it entirely against the father because of the nature of his calling. Whereas Eli was a stationary individual, lived at Shiloh. His children were under his eyeball all the time, and he didn't raise them correctly. I don't think this is the right answer, but it's one possible answer. I think the right answer probably is that Samuel's children's offense and Samuel's was much, much less than that of Eli's for a number of reasons. Eli's children, first of all, were put in the priesthood. Samuel didn't put his sons in the priesthood. He made them judges. That is, he gave them responsibility for hearing cases and deciding cases. That's very different than going and conducting the worship of Israel in the tabernacle. It's a job of importance, but it's not a job that is quite so sacred. The priest had to be holy unto the Lord in an exceptional degree. Now, all Israel was supposed to be holy to the Lord, but the priests were specially called to an unusually sacred task. And for wicked men to be in the priesthood was a defiling of a much more sacred post than to just put someone in the office of a magistrate, a judge. Now, in addition to that, I'd like to suggest that the offensive behavior of Eli's sons was far greater than that of Samuel's sons, though both were unacceptable. But Eli's sons were actually seducing the women and sleeping with the women in the tabernacle, as well as stealing portions of the sacrifice that should have been burned to the Lord and eating them themselves. I mean, these guys were just doing every corrupt thing they could imagine, totally into sensuality and totally corrupting the priestly office. Samuel's sons are said to have done nothing but bend justice. Sure, in verse 3 it says they perverted justice. The Hebrew word there is not quite as strong as our English word perverted. The Hebrew word literally means they inclined or bent justice. That is, they allowed themselves to be swayed by bribes. We could call that a perversion of justice, although perversion is a very strong word in our language. They did a bad thing. They did what no judge should do. They would hear a case, but if someone would palm them a little bit of money, they would tend to decide in favor of that person. Now, that's not a good thing. That's a very bad thing. The prophets of a later era spoke very harshly against judges who did those kinds of things. But it's still a very, to my mind, a very different kind of offense than people who are in the priesthood, committing adultery there and stealing the sacrificial meat and fat for themselves, which belong to the Lord. I mean, there is a magnitude difference in the offense. Furthermore, Eli's sons seem to have always been vile, and Eli never restrained them. We don't have any evidence that Samuel's sons were really bad men before they were put in this position. Samuel may have raised his sons quite well. They might have been decent folks for the most part, but many times men who are put into a position of power and authority tends to corrupt. It doesn't have to, but men who have shown no corruption prior to it can begin to manifest indications of bad character when put into a situation where they have the power to exploit situations or when people are offering them money. There have been many good Christian men, that is, they were good Christians in their early life, but when they were in positions where they were offered bribes or where they could just compromise a little bit and get a little richer for it, their morals begin to erode. The temptations are great in positions of power and influence, and especially if the ability to get rich by compromising a little bit is there, it takes a man as strong as Samuel to avoid that temptation. His sons were not as strong as he was. But it doesn't mean that they were as utterly corrupt and rebellious against God as Eli's sons were. Now, I'm not, some might say, well, sin is sin. All sin's the same, isn't it? No, not all sin is the same. All sin is bad. All sin is unacceptable. All sin is damnable, but not all sin is the same. Some sin is a direct thumbing of the nose against God in absolute rebellion and disdain for God and contempt for God. Other is just plain character weakness, which is also bad and punishable. But it's not necessarily a result of people who are just disdaining and showing contempt for God. It may be that they're just forgetting God or that they're justifying in their own minds a little bit of compromise here, a little bit of compromise there. Now, I may be trying to cut Samuel too much slack, but what I'm trying to explain is there is a difference in God's dealings, at least, with Eli and with Samuel, although both of them had sons who turned out to be a disappointment. But the only sense Samuel's sons are said to be disappointing is that they did take some bribes. Now, whether they did this for their whole career, whether they did this a few times and got caught and stopped doing it, we don't know. Whether they were judging more or less righteously for a while and then they began to be corrupted a little bit by the opportunity to have their palm greased a little bit. And, this happens to people who are more or less godly at an earlier stage in their life. They can be corrupted by power or by money. Whereas, as I said, Eli's sons seem to be absolutely irreligious, contemptible toward their holy duties, and totally sensuous exploiters of the people, even threatening to do violence to the worshippers if they don't comply with what they do. I mean, it is possible, because we know so little about either of these men other than the little bit that the record tells, it is possible Samuel's sons were every bit as bad as Eli's sons, but the record doesn't describe them quite as badly. They did bend justice a bit. That's not excusable. But it is of a different magnitude, it seems to me, than what Eli's sons did. And it may be that Samuel was unaware of it, too, initially. That Samuel, may have raised his sons and felt like they were decent guys and put them into their position and trusted them. And, when they were no longer under his watchful eye because he was traveling around, he was doing itinerant ministry, he wasn't there all the time, they took advantage of his absence. There are many reasons why God might have gone easier on Samuel, for the way his sons turned out than he went on Eli. Eli was much more culpable and his sons were much more wicked, at least in the way that they're described in the scriptures. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Look, you're old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us make for us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord. He said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign on them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now therefore, heed their voice, however you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. In other words, warn them, it's going to be all that rosy having a king. He's going to be a little bit of an exploiter. But if you want him, you can have him. Now, the people coming and asking for a king, you know, their request seems reasonable. For hundreds of years now, approaching 500 years, they had had judges. No king. God was the king. The judges sometimes have been decent, sometimes have been a little bad. Gideon in his later years got a little bit materialistic. Made an ephod that became a stumbling block to the children of Israel. They began to worship it. Samson was a judge, and boy, he had all kinds of corruption in his life. Immorality and, you know, violation of his vows to God and so forth. There were a number of cases where judges were not all that ideal. Eli was a nice guy, but he allowed his sons to corrupt the priesthood. And now Samuel's sons were not ideal judges either. They were capable of being bribed. And it might seem reasonable that people are tired of this situation. Let's not have an absentee king like we have. God is our God, but he doesn't seem to always keep the judges in line. We need a king who will oversee things a little more closely than this, they thought, and who will be our leader. And we need to have a visible king. After all, the nations have a visible king. The nations look at us and we don't even look like a kingdom to them. They don't even esteem us as having status as a nation because we don't have a visible king. Therefore, give us a king like all the nations have to judge us. Now, this seems reasonable on one ground at least, and that is that it looked like Samuel was getting old enough to perhaps die and his sons were unacceptable replacements for him. There was no other obvious replacement for Samuel. And so they thought, well, we should get a king. This is a good time to change to having a king. And God had predicted in the Old Testament, in the law, that the Jews would someday have kings. Genesis chapter 17. In Genesis chapter 17, God had said to Abram, I will make you exceedingly fruitful. This is verse 6. Genesis 17:6. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. Therefore, God anticipated a time when some of the descendants of Abram would be kings. But, of course, that would include not only Jewish kings, but Edomite kings and Ishmaelite kings and so forth. Many nations came out of Abraham eventually, and it would not necessitate that the Jews have kings over them in order to fulfill this particular promise. But over in Deuteronomy 17, there is a direct prediction that the Jews would come to Samuel and say these things. If you look at Deuteronomy chapter 17, at verse 14, it says, when you come into the land, this is Moses speaking, and of course the children of Israel had not yet come into Canaan at this point, they're still in the wilderness. When you come into the land which the Lord your God has given you and possess it and dwell in it and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, for the Lord has said to you, you are not to return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. And it goes on and tells how he should write a copy of the law for himself and read it every day, so that he will reign according to the dictates of God's law. In other words, although he might be a king in the political sense of the word, he is still a king who's under God's law. So he's not the highest authority. In pagan lands, a king was sovereign. A king was above all others. He was answerable to none. But in Israel, God said, when you have a king, he will be still under me. I will still be the ultimate sovereign, and he will have to read my laws and live by my laws. So you will have something that looks like a king, but he'll still not be as sovereign the nation as the kings of the nations are, because he'll be subject to me. And that would, in practical day-by-day expression mean that the king would be subject to God's prophets and even to the priests who teach the law, that the king of Israel would be subject to the law taught by the priests, to the words of prophecy given through the prophets of God. This would be a different kind of king than the nations had. Now, I would point out to you that in Deuteronomy 17:14, it looks like God is authorizing the choice of a king at some point in the future. When you come into the land, you'll have a king, and you make sure you get the king that I choose for you, and so forth. It sounds almost like it's okay for them to be king. But if you'll notice carefully, Deuteronomy 17:14 does not say, I want you to have a king. He says, you will want a king. You will insist on having a king. And when you do, this is what your king should be like. It does not indicate that God is favoring them having a king, but if they insist, if they will not be content without a king, if they require that they have a king, then God can allow this under conditions. He can allow them to have a king if they allow him to choose the king, and as long as the king lives according to the dictates God has delineated there in Deuteronomy 17. This does not mean that God wants them to come and ask for a king, or that he would be pleased for them to. But if they do, they must comply with these restrictions. Now, when the children of Israel actually came and did make this very request, it didn't please God, and it didn't please Samuel. It says specifically, God said in verse 7, that they have not rejected you, Samuel, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. Their request for a king, like all the nations had, was a rejection of God's reign over them. Back in Exodus 19, and verses 5 and 6, God had first given Israel the promise that they could be his kingdom, and he would be their king. In Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6, he said, if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then you will be a peculiar treasure to me above all nations of the earth, the Lord said, and you'll be a kingdom of priests. He said that they would be his kingdom. He would be their king. And you might remember that Gideon had once been offered the role of king of Israel back in Judges chapter 8. And he had turned it down because he saw it altogether inappropriate for any man to be the king of Israel, because they had a king already, and that was God. That is found in Judges chapter 8, verse 22 and 23. It says, then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son, and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. But Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Now, he would be their judge for the next 40 years or so, but he would not rule over them like a king, nor would his son. They were suggesting, let's set up a dynastic succession here. You can be the king, then your son can be king after you, and then your son's son will have a dynasty of Gideon. He said, nope, God's your king. You don't need a succession of kings. The king you have lives forever. You don't need a series of men succeeding one another in that position. God already occupies the position. Now, the suggestion that maybe the people were justified in asking for a king because Samuel's sons are unworthy replacement for Samuel is a vacuous argument. There were many times in the book of Judges where God raised up a judge who was not related to the previous judge. God would raise up judges out of anywhere. God could raise up of these stones, children of Abraham, and it wouldn't be required that if Samuel died that his sons must necessarily continue in the position of judges. God might raise up another, like Samuel even. Might raise up some other good ones. The people, however, didn't want to wait around for that. They wanted to have something they could see. They wanted to know the taken care of, the plans were made. When Samuel's gone, this is going to replace him. And they were just tired of this kind of occasional judge being raised by God. They didn't like the arrangement. They wanted to have something a little more predictable, a little bit more like what all the other nations had. But that basically meant they and dictate what kind of an empire and a kingdom they were going to have, and they were not leaving it up to God. Now, there's several reasons why their request was offensive to God. One was that it arose from common sense rather than prayer. That is, it just seemed sensible. That Samuel was old, his sons were not as good as he was, and therefore, it's obvious, this is the time. The time is right to set up a king. But this didn't arise out of prayer. They did not come and ask the prophet for counsel about this. They came and ordered the prophet what to do. They were definitely arrogating themselves to a position above the prophet of God. This is what we demand of you. Rather than going to the prophet humbly and say, what does the Lord say? What does God want? You know, Samuel, we're concerned. You're old. Your children are not good men, and we just don't want to see you go and leave these people behind. And, you know, is this possibly a time for us to appoint a king? Would you inquire of the Lord about that and bring us back an answer? They didn't come humbly to inquire of the prophet of God. They came bringing their demands to the prophet of God. Yes, Ted? Yes. Arrogating means lifting themselves up. It's related to the word arrogant, you know. You know what that means, I imagine. And being prideful and exalting themselves above the prophet, you know. It's spelled also the word arrogant, only the last few letters are different. Yes. And another thing here is that it seems as though they were asking for a king, not of the sort that God actually intended to give them. But they wanted a king like the kings of all the other nations. That is, a supreme head of their nation who was human. Now, God did give them a king, but he never did allow that this king would be like the kings of the nations. He required that the king that he gave them would be subject to him. And even though Saul turned out to be a bad king, he still was, and he didn't obey the prophet. He was held accountable for not doing so. He was rejected because he didn't obey the prophet. He did obey the prophet in measure because he was intimidated by the prophet, but he didn't always obey, and for this he lost his kingdom. So even though God does seem to give in here and give them what they request, he doesn't give them exactly what they request. They want a king like the nations have, a supreme sovereign in human form. But God's not going to give anything that much right over Israel. He's going to remain the king, whether they want him or not, but they will give he will give a figurehead person to stand as king and as a leader with something more of a governmental function more than the judges had and more of an identity that the nation can rally behind as sort of a national symbol and figure. But God's disdain for this choice is recorded in the book of Hosea. Of course, Hosea was written hundreds of years later after Saul had been given and Saul had died and many other kings had succeeded him since then. But in Hosea chapter 13, in verses 10 and 11, God said, I will be your king. Where is any other that he may save you in all your cities? And your judges to whom you said, give me a king and princes. I gave you a king in my anger, and I took him away in my wrath. This is referring to Saul. I gave you a king. But he says, I did so in my anger. That means although God gave them what they wanted, he was angry when he did so. He was not saying, okay, that sounds good to me too. But he actually gave them the request, but with it, leanness of soul, as one of the Psalms says about another situation. But Samuel, of course, immediately perceived the wrongness of their request, but he went and prayed about it. And God said, go ahead and give them what they want, but warn them what it'll be like. And don't take it so personally, Samuel. Sure, it looks like they're rejecting you and your sons, but they're really rejecting me. So, I mean, Don't take it personally. Realize that I'm the one that they're rejecting. They don't like the man that I set up. And says to him in verse 8, according to all the works which they have done since the day I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. In other words, Samuel, if you feel the rejection, if you feel a little bit upset that they don't approve of you anymore, realize you're just kind of participating with me in rejection. I've been rejected by them all along when they've worshipped these other gods. Now you get a little taste of what it feels like to me. They're doing it to you now, too. Now, in verse 10, Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons, appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen. And some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties. He will set some to plow his ground, to reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. Now, you might say, what's the problem there? You know, I mean, in other words, he'll hire some of your sons and daughters to work in the palace, to be in the military. In our day, that would not be considered to be such an exploitation. I mean, so what? Lots of people voluntarily choose a career in the military. It's considered an honorable career to many people. A lot of families would be pleased if their children went into a career in the military and worked in on the president's cabinet or in some government job under the president. I mean, what's so bad about them taking our sons and daughters doing that? What you have to realize is that until this time, Israel had no standing army. No one had a career in the military. It was always a makeshift, ad hoc fighting force that was gathered when a crisis rose. Most of the time, they didn't need a standing army. When the Philistines or the Moabites or the Midianites came or whatever, God would raise up a leader. And then people who had no military career would simply leave home to fight the battle. Then they'd go home. The place for the sons and daughters was not to go to work for the government, but to be at home. Most fathers wanted their sons to grow up and take over the farm or the family business. Their mothers wanted the daughters to be raised to be homemakers, not bakers and perfumers in the king's palace. You see, in our day, where the assumption is that people don't take over their parents' business and they don't follow in their parents' footsteps, the idea that people can go out and find a career that suits them, all of this warning is lost on us. I mean, so what? What's the big problem here? I mean, so the king is going to hire some of your guys to be in the military and to be in his cabinet and some of your people to work his confectionaries and so forth in the palace. That sounds like work. What's so bad with that? But you see, what it's saying is, whereas you people would really, of course, prefer, as all generations before you would, that your children would take over the work at the farm and your daughters would stay home and you'd be able to teach them to take care of the home so they can marry well, and then you can have your grandchildren raised nearby and so forth. This is not going to happen. Your children will be taken from you. They're going to go live in the capital. They're going to go in to be career soldiers. There's going to be a standing army. And your sons will be taken away from you. They'll be drafted into this army, and the sons that you would rather have around will be taken from you to serve this king. And that was something that would not be desirable in those days. I don't think it's desirable now. It's just that people don't know it's not desirable. He goes on. Listen to this heavy taxation they're going to have to submit themselves to. Verse 15. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. In other words, government officials. A tenth. 10% taxation. This is represented as exploitative. You know, listen, this is what you're going to be facing. He's going to take 10% of your income to support his government policies and officers. And this is supposed to make them say, whoa, are we making a mistake? How could we have ever thought for a moment that we should have a king if he's going to take 10% of us in taxation? Of course, the reason I make an issue of this is that many people in the United States, I think middle class people, pay about 40% now in regular tax, because the king and his officials are involved in so many areas of life and provide so many services and policies and have so many organizations to support and so much staff and so much welfare and all that stuff that I mean, taxes keep going higher and higher. And now I think, I'm not at a taxable bracket myself, so I'm not in personal touch, but I think I've heard, isn't it so? About 40% is what middle-class people pay in taxes right now? That's four times as much as what the king was going to charge them to run his programs, and that was considered to be a real burden. That was considered to be real exploitative, you know, and this was supposed to let them know what big mistake they're making. He's going to take 10% from you to run his government programs and the military and all that stuff. Now, one thing this tells us is that apparently in the sight of God, 10% should be enough for a government to run all of its necessary services. The Bible does teach in the New Testament as well, there is a place for government service of sorts. In Romans 13 and in 1 Peter 2, we're told that government is ordained by God to punish evildoers and to praise those who do well. Obviously, national security and policing of criminals and so forth is legitimate government business. And of course, that's what the king would have to do. The king of Israel would have to do that kind of stuff. But God felt like that could be adequately done by taxing citizenry 10%. And I personally believe it could be done today, if the government would just do what it's ordained to do and not get involved in every other kind of thing. If the government would get its hands out of education and out of, you know, all kinds of relief programs, stuff that are not really the business of government to do. I'm not saying people shouldn't be educating children and that people shouldn't be relieving the poor. They should be, but the government doesn't have to do that. That never was, in ancient times, the government's job, and it isn't now. And in my opinion, it'd be a much better situation, much more biblical, if the government would just get back to its one job that God ordained it to do, and that's to keep the peace, provide a general security of the citizenry, a punishment of criminals and so forth, and an encouragement to good living, without even provide national defense. I mean, some would say that's not necessary, but I mean, the government I personally think that that's legitimate government activity. But that could be done on 10% of the gross national product. And yet because the government has so many other things it has taken to itself to do, often without much approval from the citizens, services to provide and so forth, it has to tax us so much more. But I just find it almost, I find it humorous that Samuel suggested them that this guy's going to take a tenth year increase to support his government. And that was really bad. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your finest young men and his and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, because of your king which you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. So you'll really be crying out under this oppression when he takes 10% of your income. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, no, but we will have a king over us. Now, this is apparently Samuel is giving them a chance to change their mind by telling them how hard it was going to be, how it was going to change their life for the worse by having a king. And he was hoping, perhaps, to dissuade them from their ill-advised request. But they made the wrong decision. They heard the warnings, but they said, no, we're still going to go the way we said. We want a king so that we may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of the Lord. Now, of course, the Lord heard them too, but he just went back and talked to the Lord about it and shared, you know, what the people had said and his concerns about it. So the Lord said to Samuel, heed their voice and make them a king. And Samuel said to the men of Israel, every man go to his city. Now, the next few chapters raise some interesting questions about chronology. I don't know if you found this so as you read through this section, but we are introduced to Saul in chapter 9. And he gets anointed by Samuel in chapter 10. And then he leads, proclaimed king in chapter 10. Then he leads the children of Israel in a battle, which they win, in chapter 11. And then he's actually coronated in chapter 12. And some of the things that are related, they almost seem like they might be related out of their chronological order for various reasons, which I will note as we come to the specific statements that I think give the impression there may be a shuffling of the chronological order of these events. I don't have any doubts about the integrity of the accounts. I just don't know at what point there may be times when it's going back and telling us something that happened earlier without us knowing that that's what it's doing. For example, in chapter 10, we will find in verse 17 that Samuel called the people together to the Lord again at Mizpah, and he rehearses to them the fact that they, in verse 19, he says, today you have rejected your God who himself saved you out of all your adversities, saying, no, set us a king over us. So it sounds like this is almost immediately after the close of chapter 8. When he sent them all home, now he regathered them, and here he appoints Saul to be the king and presents him to the people. It's possible that all the things in chapter 9 and earlier in chapter 10 happened after chapter 8. But there's, I don't know, it's very subjective, and I could be wrong. It just seems as if chapter 8 verse or chapter 10 verse 17 follows very closely after the close of chapter 8. And it's made me wonder, although it's not a very important question to answer, it's just made me wonder whether what we read in chapter 9 of the encounter with Saul and Samuel, the private meeting of them, whether this goes back maybe even to a time before the people asked for a king. That God anticipated that Saul was going to be the king, and he caused Samuel to meet him and to even act in the way he did toward him. And then later when the people asked for him, Samuel presented this man to him in chapter 10. This is not at all a necessary reconstruction of the passage. It's just the fact that many times in the Old Testament, stories may be put in a place other than their chronological place because of the storyteller's license that he uses. For instance, in Genesis, we saw again and again that a particular important character would be, his death would be recorded at a point much earlier than it really occurred in the narrative because the storyteller just wanted to get wanted to get the man out of the story so he could concentrate on something else. So we read about the death of Abraham before we read of the birth of Jacob and Esau, even though Abraham lived beyond the death, the birth of Jacob and Esau. We read of the death of Isaac before of the story of Joseph, and yet Isaac lived well into the time that Joseph was sold into slavery. But the storyteller just, you know, will by way of anticipation tell something that really happened at a later date, or sometimes will go back and double back and tell something that happened earlier. I'm not saying it's absolutely necessary in the section before us, chapters 9 through about 12 or 13, to assume that this happened. But there are times when the chronology seems a little confusing. And one possibility is that portions of the story might be related as sort of a flashback to an earlier thing that happened, or maybe even anticipating something that happened on your date. We cannot assume always that things are told in exactly their chronological place. Though I don't want to make it sound like we can't just take it at face value. It can be taken at face value too. Chapter 9 says there was a man of Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Becherah, the son of Aphia, a Benjamite, a mighty man of power, probably meaning of affluence, of wealth. And he had a son whose name was Saul. Interestingly, the name Saul means asked for. And he became the king that the people had asked for. His name was Saul, a choice and handsome young man. There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. Now, this is stated as an absolute, and it may well have been absolute. He might have literally been the tallest man in the whole nation of millions of people. Although the statement may be more hyperbole. It may mean that it was very rare for anyone to be as tall as him. But for the most part, he was much taller than the average Jew. He was head and shoulders taller. And the most handsome man in the country. The same thing is later said of Absalom, but of course their lives did not overlap, so they could be literally true in the most absolute sense, or it could be a hyperbole. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost, and Kish said to his son Saul, "Please take one of the servants with you, and arise, go and look for the donkeys." So he passed through the mountains of Ephraim, through the land of Shalisha, but he did not find them. Then they passed through the land of Shealim, and they were not there. Then he passed through the land of the Benjamites, but they did not find them. And when they had come to the land of Zuph, Saul said to his servant who was with him, "Come, let us return, lest my father cease caring about the donkeys and become worried about us." And he said to him, apparently the servant said to Saul, "Look now, there is in this city a man of God, and he is an honorable man. All that he says surely comes to pass, so let us go there. Perhaps he can show us the way that we should go." Now, let me talk about this a little bit. The first point I want to make is not perhaps a very significant one, maybe not even a valid one, but it strikes me as a possible point of significance that the first two kings of Israel were Saul and David. Saul's name means asked for. He was the people's choice, although God, of course, selected him. He selected him because the people had chosen to have a king. David was God's choice. David was a man after God's heart, and David wasn't seeking to be king, nor was Israel seeking a new king when God chose David. He was, strictly speaking, God's man. Saul was the people's choice. When we first read of David, he's a shepherd tending sheep. David was a man who would be more likely out searching for lost sheep on any given day than any other activity, because he had to watch for the strays and cover them and so forth. And like Moses, who was a shepherd for 40 years before he led the people of Israel, David was a shepherd. He followed sheep. He led sheep. He chased down sheep. Saul, when we first see him, is unlike. He's not chasing lost sheep. He's looking for lost asses, looking for lost donkeys. That may not be significant. I don't want to read too much into that. But it strikes me as perhaps an important commentary on the two men. David was called to lead Israel when they were in a better place with God, because after this they repent of having asked for a king. They still keep a king, but they repent. They become again more faithful to God, and God chooses a shepherd to shepherd his sheep. At this point, though, the people are rebellious against God. They're more like donkeys. And so he chooses a man who tends donkeys. to be the leader of the nation. And donkeys are an unclean animal. And for Israel to be compared to donkeys would be an insulting sort of a thing. Now, the Bible nowhere makes an issue here that Saul was chasing donkeys or that he was a tent of donkeys when God called him, and the donkeys represent Israel. That point is never made. But the Bible frequently makes the point that David, the shepherd of sheep, became the shepherd of Israel, and Israel are God's sheep. And if that is significant, then it may also be significant that Saul, the first leader, was a tender of donkeys, and that Israel at that time were unclean, they were stubborn, they were not like God's sheep, they were more like stubborn donkeys. But God chose a man who tended donkeys to tend them. At a later date, when they were on better terms with God, when they were more like God's sheep, he chose a man who tended sheep to tend the nation. Now, perhaps more importantly, is verse 6. Saul and his servant happened to be near the place where Samuel is. As it turns out, Samuel's not mentioned by name, and that's something significant. The servant says, there's a man of God who lives in this city. He's an honorable man. It's like he's introducing someone that Saul's not familiar with. You know, this is a good guy. Doesn't mention his name. It's not like the man of God, you know, his name's a household word throughout Israel. But it turns out to be Samuel. And this is what's peculiar. Because we read that Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. And the last we read of Samuel in chapter 8, he was an old man. So certainly he would have been known throughout the whole nation. If anyone's name was a household word throughout the nation of Israel, it would be Samuel. And yet the servant speaks about Samuel here in ways almost as if, you know, he's not all that acquainted with this man. Doesn't even call him by name. And it's like he has to tell Saul about this man's existence. You know, there's this man of God here. He's an honorable man. Whatever he says comes to pass. He sounds like he's talking about basically a stranger. And not just a stranger in the sense of someone they've never personally met, but someone that they're not really very aware of. I mean, the servant shows an awareness of him that the impression is given that Saul didn't know much about this guy, and the servant had to inform him that this man of God, he's honorable, God honors his words, and so forth. And that's peculiar. Now, I don't want to read too much into it, but this is one of the things that makes me wonder about the chronology of the story. I don't know. It is possible that this story relates to an earlier time when Samuel was not yet as well known. And that in anticipation, God knew the people were going to later ask for a king when Samuel got old. And in anticipation of that, God had introduced Saul to Samuel and even given an inkling that Saul would in fact be the king that God would raise up at their later request. How much clearer, we don't know. But I'll tell you one thing that makes me think this is a possibility is it says, let's put it this way. Saul is represented as a son living at his father's house in this story. He may have been married with children, but it's not indicated they did. And the impression is given that he's a young man living at home with his father. He goes off looking for his father's donkey. He's gone for several days. He doesn't worry that his wife and children might worry about him. He's worried his dad might be worried about him. Just the flavor of it sounds like he's a young man still living at home, not yet a man who's left home and started a family or anything like that. Yet, when Saul actually becomes king, in chapter 13 we read, Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, he chose for himself 3,000 men. And then we read, in verse 2 there, that Jonathan, Saul's son in Gibeah, had the rest of the armies under his command. Now, Saul had been reigning for 2 years, and he's got an adult son who's heading up part of the army. Now, I'm not saying that anything can be decided with certainty about this, but it just seems strange. It seems that Saul is not depicted as a man with adult children in chapter 9. But 2 years after he comes to his throne, he's got an adult son leading part of the armies, which may indicate a great number of years passing between the events of chapter 9 and the actual coronation of Saul. It is possible, it seems to me, I don't say it must be seen this way, but it is possible that Saul, as a young man, had this experience of which we're reading, when Samuel was still relatively unknown. Samuel was still perhaps fairly young even still. And that Samuel had this encounter with Saul to indicate him that he would someday be the king. But that actual choosing of him as a king, even the request of the people that they should have a king, may have come years and years later. Now, maybe I'm spending more time on this possibility than it warrants. But there are some of these factors in the passage that made me wonder. Maybe this is related a little bit out of its context. You know, I mean, it is very possible. Because we have a story like that in Genesis chapter 38, where we read of Joseph's brothers selling him in slavery. Then next we read a whole chapter about Judah separating from his brothers and having three sons, and they grow up and so forth. And all of this is somehow sandwiched in between Joseph being sold into slavery and him arriving in Egypt and being purchased by Potiphar. It's obvious that that's a parenthesis of sorts. And this could maybe be a parenthesis. It's maybe that now that the author has told us about the people requesting a king, and later in chapter 10, verse 17, he's going to tell how the king actually was installed as per the request. But in parenthesis, chapter 9 and the early part of 10 may be given as sort of a flashback to an earlier time this man Saul had encountered Samuel in the way that we're about to read. And this, of course, is the man that was eventually installed as king. It is possible that the book is constructed with that structure. But again, we don't know.
Think it would be pretty weird then.
Very much. But I think Saul did think it was pretty weird. In fact, when he got anointed, he was very surprised. He said nothing about it for us. See, there's another thing here. Later on in chapter 10, Saul gets anointed. He returns home, and his uncle asks him where he's been. He says, "We went and saw Samuel." And his uncle in verse 15, chapter 10, verse 15, said, "Tell me, please, what Samuel said to you." And it's verse 16 says, "So Saul said to his uncle, he told us plainly that the donkeys had been found. It says, but about the matter of the kingdom, he did not tell him what Samuel had said." Now, this is interesting. He didn't say about the matter of him being king, but about the matter of the kingdom. The idea of Israel becoming a kingdom with a king is what was implied by Samuel's anointing of Saul. And by the way, when Samuel anointed Saul in chapter 10, he didn't say, God's chosen you to be the king, but he's chosen you to be the commander of my people. And it may be that this was at an earlier time, before there was actual talk of a king. But rather, he was anointed to be the commander, with the implication that there would someday be him and he would be the king as well. But there was a period of time, apparently, that Saul kept all this to himself. His uncle actually inquired what transpired between him and Samuel, and he kept back information about the reference to a kingdom, and him being the king someday or whatever. How long this silence was maintained, we don't know, but it may have been for years. And then later, when the people asked for a king, as chapter 8 tells about, and so forth, then Samuel went ahead and coronated Saul, whom he had earlier anointed in this way. I don't know. This may be correct. But it is one way of dealing with the fact that Saul appears to be a young man in his father's house in chapter 9, but 2 years after he's made king, he's got an adult son leading part of the army. There does seem to be reason to suggest a past years there. Also, it would tend to explain a little better why it is that in chapter number 6, the servant and Saul seem only vaguely acquainted with Samuel, who he is. Whereas, at the later time in life, all the people of Israel came to Samuel saying, "You're the one who needs to make a king." I mean, Samuel is widely recognized. And yet they speak of him in the vaguest terms here. And when they saw Samuel, by the way, they didn't know it was him. Later in this story, as we read on, which we will here in chapter 9, they read on, and they meet Samuel, but they don't know that Samuel they've met. I mean, he's not a real familiar guy to them. And it may point to an earlier time in Samuel's life that this actual story occurred. Now, the servant suggested that they go inquire of the seer, of the prophet. But verse 7 says, "Saul said to his servant, but look, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread in our vessels is all gone, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What then?" And the servant answered Saul again and said, "Look, I have here in my hand 1/4 of a shekel of silver. I will give that to the man of God and tell us our way." Now, this doesn't mean that the prophets sold their prophecies, but it was customary to give him an honorarium. You know, the man of God lived perhaps off such gifts. And if somebody went and used his services, it seemed like it was only fair to give him some token of appreciation. Saul thought it would be inappropriate to ask him when he didn't have anything to give him. And the servant have a little bit, we'll go and talk to him. Verse 9, "Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he thus spoke, Come, let us go to the seer. For he who is now called a prophet was formerly called a seer. Then Saul said to his servant, Well said, come, let us go. So they went to the city where the man of God was. As they went up the hill to the city, they met some young women going out to draw water, and said to them, Is the seer here? And they answered them and said, Yes, there he is, just ahead of you. Hurry now, for today he came to this city, because there is a sacrifice of the people today on the high place. As soon as you come into the city, you will surely find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now, therefore, go up. About this time you will find him. So they went up to the city. As they were coming into the city, there was Samuel coming toward them on his way up to the high place. Now, one issue has to be addressed here briefly is, why were they offering sacrifices on the high place? They were supposed to offer sacrifices only in the tabernacle. I mean, that was explicit. Sacrifices were supposed to be associated with the tabernacle and the brazen altar and the whole ritual there. They weren't allowed to offer sacrifices on the high places. That's where the Canaanites did. God often punished Israel for doing that in other times. What's the story here? And Samuel's a party to this. What's going on? I would suggest that because the tabernacle had been wrecked and pillaged by the Philistines, and the ark had been taken, of course it had been returned in the meantime, but there was a disruption of the ceremonial worship at Shiloh, which for reasons perhaps beyond that which are recorded, they had neglected or been unable to reestablish. Perhaps some of the furniture of the tabernacle had not been recovered. Perhaps there was no altar, and they weren't sure if it would be right to make one or whatever. But things were at an abnormal situation. The tabernacle was not in use. And therefore, apparently, God allowed them, for that time being, or at least didn't punish them, for offering their sacrifices in other locations. But they couldn't do it just anywhere. The prophet had to be there as God's agent to bless it. Now, see, one reason God forbade the children of Israel earlier to offer sacrifices anywhere other than the tabernacle is that if people are offering sacrifices everywhere, hither and yon, they might begin offering sacrifices to pagan deities. And it would be something that the institutional priesthood could not keep their finger on the pulse of everything that was going on, couldn't supervise it all. And in certain little areas, geographical areas, people might be offering sacrifices and be doing it to other gods. But no one would know it. Strict worship of Jehovah could not be enforced if people could offer sacrifices anywhere they wanted in every private place. So they were required to do it only at the tabernacle. But perhaps it was understood that God will make a provision if the prophet comes. The prophet of God comes. He has to supervise it. He has to bless the sacrifice. He's got to, we've got to make sure this stays within the perimeters of the true worship of Jehovah. And under those conditions, God would allow a sacrifice be offered in a different location than the tabernacle. I think, reading between the lines, that's probably how we are to respond to this information, that the prophet was going up to the high place, they're going to offer a sacrifice, and they can't offer it until he came to bless it. Okay? So they meet Samuel. Verse 15, Now the Lord had told Samuel in his ear the day before Saul came, saying, Tomorrow about this time I'll send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall appoint him commander over my people of Israel. Notice he doesn't use the word king at this point. That he may serve my people from the hand of the Philistines. Save my people from the hand of the Philistines. For I have looked upon my people because their cry has come to me. And when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, There he is, the man whom I spoke to you of. This is the one who will reign over my people. Then Saul drew near to Samuel in the gate and said, Please tell me, where is the seer's house? They didn't recognize Samuel. And Samuel answered and said, I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today. And tomorrow I will let you go. I will tell you all that is in your heart. But as for your donkeys that were lost 3 days ago, do not be anxious about them, for they have been found. And on whom is all the desire of Israel? Is it not on you and on all your father's house? Now that statement was a bit ambiguous, that all of Israel's desire is upon you and your father's house. Saul himself recognized that that meant there'd be something very significant about him and his father's house, and he thought it strange. He said, Am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak like this to me? Then Samuel took Saul and his servant and brought them into the hall and had them sit in the place of honor among those who were invited, and they were about 30 persons. And Samuel said to the cook, "Bring the portion which I gave you, of which I said to you, set it apart." And the cook took up the thigh with its upper part and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, "Here it is, what was kept back. It was set apart for you. Eat, for until this time it has been kept for you, since I said I invited the people." So Saul ate with Samuel that day. And when they had come down from the high place to the city, Samuel spoke with Saul on the top of the house. They arose early, and it was about the dawning of the day that Samuel called to Saul on the top of the house, saying, "Get up, that I may send you on your way." And Saul arose, and both of them went outside, and he and Samuel. Now, as they were going down to the outskirts of the city, Samuel said to Saul, "Tell the servant..."